The army doesn't like more than one disaster in a day.
Looks bad in the newspapers and upset civilians at their breakfast.
I'm Bill Buppert, retired army officer and a regular warfare practitioner and scholar. Welcome to Chasing Ghosts and a Regular Warfare podcast, the show that examines the mythos, lost history, bad thinking, martial malpractice, and government incompetence that informs so much of irregular warfare. I want to peek behind the curtain at the vast machinery and briar patch politics of insurgency and counterinsurgency and everything in between. Now, let's go ghost hunting together. Hello, this is Bill, and welcome to episode 061 of Chasing Ghosts and Irregular Warfare podcast. The title of this one is The Mountains of Madness, Military Defeat and Terrain. So what I wanted to discuss was there's a number of things contemporaneously in the media today and what's catching people's attention concerning what one can arguably call the mountain fastness of Yemen, which is the place where the Houthi occupying pretty much the western third of the country in a very mountainous region in Yemen, which has been engaged in a civil war, one can say arguably for a very long time, but it really came to a head between 2014 and 2016 when the Obama administration gave a wink and a nod to the Saudis and other members of the Saudi coalitions there to enter the country and get in the middle of this civil war. Then, of course, we have Iran, which, again, part of the consistently and persistently embattled Shia crescent since the middle of the 20th century through this point. What we've discovered is that since the CIA coup in that country in 1953, leading up to the 1979 Islamic fundamentalist coup and takeover of the country, this resulted in a constant battle of wills between the U.S., the West, and Iran and Iraq. As any savvy ground interloper overseas or wherever the case may be, where a war is started by one country with a coalition or without a coalition against others, what you discover is that mountainous terrain tends to be very problematic and difficult, not only because it can be cold, and by the way, not always is mountainous terrain cold, as we saw in the mountains of Vietnam and the mountains of Cambodia, where you had a temperate to tropical climate that did have mountain fastness that were a different flavor than one would find, for instance, what the Italians and the Austro-Hungarian Empire were fighting in World War I, what you would find in some of the mountain fighting in northern Italy in World War II, and then, of course, what you would find with the two failed British campaigns, the one failed Russian campaign, and the one spectacularly failed U.S. campaign in Afghanistan in the foothills of the Himalayas, as it were. I have more than a passing personal acquaintance with mountains and mountain fighting. With mountains, I spent part of my youth with my blessed aunt and uncle who took me in due to various problematic family dynamics that found me in their fold. Thank the gods, and I will always be grateful for what my aunt and uncle offered me up in the little burg of Meat Camp, North Carolina, outside of Boone, where I was sort of saturated and happily so in the foxfire and Appalachian confines of mountain lore, mountain folk, mountain shooting, mountain hunting, and all the rest of it, and got to know the folks up there, came to really appreciate their capabilities and abilities to do what they did. One will find, if one goes back to the first American Civil War, which occurred between 1775 and 1783, ending with the final divorce from London at the Treaty of Paris in 1783, that the mountain fastness and the hill people and just the crusty, crockety and very able fighting skills of mountain people were emblematic at that time in the Americas. But of course, one can go around the world and you will find that mountain people tend to be, for the most part, rather hardy and rather good at fighting when push comes to shove. The Chechens come to mind. The Kurds come to mind. I mentioned earlier that I had been raised for a short period of time in my life in the mountains of North Carolina, and I came away from that with a great appreciation of the culture and some of the peculiarities of the area that made them very savvy fighting men, for instance. Then I find myself later on in life fighting in those Himalayan foothills in Afghanistan, in this case, northern Afghanistan, and finding that we're fighting the most sophisticated military organization in the 21st century, the U.S. Army, and its co-conspirators in the U.S. Air Force, and of course, other branches of other services who happen to have been engaged there. Again, America maintained its sterling record of stalemate and defeat, being defeated by an army, in this case, the Taliban, and all of the other hundreds of resistance organizations that peppered across the fruited plain in Afghanistan, and their capability to fight under circumstances that were cold, rough, full of privation, but came to the fight with a hardiness and a resilience that would put the best fighters on planet Earth to shame at any one time. I am fond of saying, as a guy who was partially raised as a ruralite, that city people, urban folk, pride themselves on their lack of self-sufficiency. It's part of their cosmopolitan conceit that their refrigerators may have condiments, but they don't need food. They don't need to have the capability to fix what they have. They have access to better paying jobs and such. And they take great pride in their lack of self-sufficiency because it also gives them cachet and the social capital to brag about being part of the greater population, part of the folks who all put their shoulders to the wheel, whether voluntarily or not, to make a community out of something, whereas rural folks pride themselves on their self-sufficiency. Hence, rural folks throughout martial history and throughout recent history and culturally and even anthropologically find themselves at the sharp end on occasion of the city folk dwellers who wish to be interlopers in their mountain fastness or their rural communities, and a lot of them find themselves coming to harm, not the rural folk, that is, but the city folk who don their military garb and go in there and try to push them around. Being a former Appleseed instructor, which was a marksmanship clinic and a history clinic discussing the three strikes of the match on April 19th, 1775 at Lexington and Concord, and how this led to the beginning of the divorce proceedings with London in that first civil war between America and as a British nation and other British nationals who wanted to keep them in the fold in spite of their eagerness to leave the orbit of London and their various taxation, regulation, and legal confines and straitjackets that they had imposed on the Atlantic seaboard at the time. As an Appleseed instructor, we also had to be very conversant in what happened in those first years during the American Revolution. So I took it upon myself to read deeply and drink deeply of the history of the time. And what you find consistently in the Southern campaigns is that Southern men who aren't bred in cities but happen to grow up in rural areas, and by the way, on the Atlantic seaboard at the time, at the end of the 18th century, most people were laborers, most people were farmers, most people were the folks who would, from dawn till dusk, work with an industry even the British were wowed at. Up until the 1920s, 30s, and 40s in the Appalachian Mountains, it was very hard to tame and curb the more ebullient and illegal enterprises, let's say, of alcohol running, marijuana production, all those kind of things. And that still runs through Southron culture today. So here we have in America this exemplar and instantiation of just how hardy mountain folk can be. And to a limited extent, we have to hearken back in history to see it, but we see snippets of it even in the early 20th century, as I just alluded to, of just how savvy they are when it comes to martial arts, both open hand and with weapons in hand. So now we fast forward to today in the 21st century, and for those of you who are perennial listeners of both my podcast, War Notes, a conventional conflict podcast, and of course, Chasing Ghost, which is the original gangster in the podcasting that I've done, this being episode 61, we can see all of a sudden, I had thought with the new administration that war-making planet-wide would start to ebb more than flow, would start to seek peace around the planet, since peace is the best way for mankind and civilization to advance in a positive fashion. But now we see saber rattling, and the saber rattling tends to be around two countries as we speak, one which has consumed both sides of the aisle, and the other one, well, wait, it has consumed both sides of the aisle. That would be Yemen and Iran. And how has this legendary U.S. and Western air power worked against mountainous Western Yemen, which just so happens to be that geographical center I just described of gravity, for the Houthis, who are the ones who are giving that very narrow sea called the Red Sea, which is a major route to the Suez Canal, a run for their money, quite literally. We see the Navy, as I have mentioned before in previous podcasts, the U.S. Navy, they need to fire everybody in their PR department, saying, and I paraphrase, in the Red Sea with all the carrier battle groups and such and all the air sorties and the generation of missile salvo competition and such between what is essentially a non-naval power. I remind all my listeners once again, the Houthis have maybe 1975 and older Russian, it would be Soviet, patrol boats in their Navy. They have no Navy to speak of, but the U.S. Navy said they had been in some of the, and I'm paraphrasing here, the most intense naval combat since World War II. Oh my, that, because that's quite the statement. And by the way, my hat's off to this third world country called Yemen, which is the one that inspired me to change my mind taxonomically and dismissing the very notion of a bifurcation between near peer and peer. I will no longer ever employ the term near peer because third world countries like Yemen have proven that they are peers to the U.S. Navy, if not all the U.S. and Western armed forces as we speak, and they remain a persistent and perennial thorn in the side of free sea commerce in the Red Sea. In war, in conflict, geography is destiny. Men who know terrain, men who know how to read terrain, know how to work the angles, because angles in conflict are critically important. Terrain in conflict is critically important. Weather in the same terrain is critically important. And taking all of these elements and your fighting forces, especially if they happen to be expeditionary instead of defending, as the Yemenis and the Iranians would be doing, what you would discover is that these are going to be very tough nuts to crack. So I'm going to try to err on the side of underestimating instead of overestimating. So when I take a swag, a wild-ass guess at the terrain features and topography and base relief of both Yemen and Iran, I come up with these figures. Yemen is approximately 40,000 square miles of mountainous terrain, which means that Yemen itself is almost 200,000 square miles from east to west in that particular country that happens to be at the end of that peninsula, right near the entrance to the Red Sea in the south. Take a look at a map sometime. So I'm calling that approximately 20%. Now, for those who have been either watching people swagger, watching the sword rattling, watching the spears being shaken, and all of the jingoistic noises towards Iran, you need to take a look at a map because, again, geography is destiny. And when I did my swag on Iran, what you discover, especially when it comes to the western reaches of that country bordering the Persian Gulf. It is a tremendously mountainous region. As a matter of fact, I would swag that approximately 400,000 square miles of mountains, almost 50% of the country, is mountains. Now, again, I said these are terrain swags favoring a low number because a geographer, whether professional or amateur out there, can come with much more precise figures. But that's not the point of this, to come up with the most precise figures, but areas of consensus that we can have. Now, I suspect a proper cartographer of Iran would call it north of 65%, but we're going to roll with 50%. Now, let's go to the Ukraine and mountainous areas, which are primarily in the western reaches, the Carpathian and Crimean Mountains. They account for roughly 5% of Ukraine's land area. So invasions, even in the 21st century, find mountainous terrain a tremendous operational challenge. I think that that will remain the case, even with all the revolutions in military affairs that I reluctantly, but actually joyfully, proclaim to everybody who's paying attention that the way of war has changed in such a fashion in this century that this may go down in the hallmarks of conflict and war history as one of the momentous times of change that we've seen before, intersystem, interstellar, intergalactic warfare comes to the fore and everything technologically and by tactics, techniques, and procedures that that does, especially if one discovers faster than light travel. But that's a discussion for another day. If America uses nukes again, in case they get very frustrated, or maybe even partners in the coalition in NATO who happen to have nukes, like the UK and the French, that's not going to solve any of these problems. It will be a tactical employment, and it will uncover and take out of Pandora's box a number of menu decisions for war that mankind would be better off not considering whatsoever. As you know, I'm on Twitter, and half my time I'm talking about conflict futurism, contemporaneous conflict, maybe historical conflict and war and such on there. There's several folks that I follow that I would urge you to do the same. My handle on Twitter is at W. Bubert, just like my last name is spelled. And in this case, there's two guys I go to for a lot of my history and conflict analysis and observations and share things with them, and we have conversations on occasion. But I have to defer to their wisdom in certain areas in which I don't have mastery when it comes to conflict. And one of those gentlemen is Will Shriver, who also has a Substack. In the show notes, I will put his Twitter handle so that you can visit him. I urge you to follow him. He has really terrific observations. So at one point, I think this was March 28th, 2025, he said, for anyone out there who believes the U.S. can mount a ground invasion of Iran, I challenge you to describe an order of battle and a credible operational scenario. For those who believe an air campaign alone will defeat Iran, describe for me a credible chain of events. So he has a variety of interesting interlocutors who take up his challenge and say, yep, well, we could do it this way, and that. He goes on to dismiss all of them. And he has some interesting observations, among which is, I find it amazing, I'm quoting Will here, I find it amazing that so many people seriously believe the U.S. will launch nuclear strikes against Iran. It will be the single greatest strategic blunder in America's history. The U.S. would become a pariah state, and the downstream consequences would destroy Western civilization. End of quote. I happen to agree with that. I think that uncorking that particular conflict genie is a road one can't step back from. Will goes on, China imports over 90% of Iranian oil exports. Chinese warships will escort those shipments as necessary. The rules-based international order is over, and as for the imagined omnipotence of the U.S. Navy, it can't even open the Bab el-Mandeb, which happens to be that choke point near the southwestern corner of Yemen on the Red Sea. So I bring up these points concerning Yemen and Iran because America just spent more than two decades in a failed conflict in Afghanistan in which they were fighting, especially in the northeastern reaches of Afghanistan, as I mentioned before, in the Himalayan foothills and even the Himalayas, as it were. And what you discover is that fighting in that kind of territory is gruesomely difficult in so many ways. I am not a climber or mountaineer, but I am a former technical climber in my youth. And the difficulty of fighting against gravity with your body weight, much less all the climbing accoutrement as a sport climber that you would try to bring up vertical faces, much less all the equipment that is necessary in order to fight a war or a campaign in 20th and 21st century circumstances, it's enormous. The level of fitness, the level of accommodation to the medical issues that are very unique to high altitude fighting. You can ask the Indians and the Pakistani who have been fighting in the Kashmir now since the 1950s, just what that's like, where not only is a bullet in your body or being proximate to an artillery shell burst a hazard to your life, but so is the very altitude and the thinness of the air that you are breathing on an everyday basis is also a threat to your life, because the energy expenditure for a soldier, which even in tropical climes can be enormous, especially as the beasts of burdens and Marius's mules of carrying that 70 to 110 pounds of kit on a raid or on a meeting engagement, whether hasty or deliberate, it wears on your body. But then again, when you are in the high altitude fastness of mountain fighting, as the Italians discovered from 1915 to 1918, the White War in the Dolomites and other mountainous areas, just absolutely grueling. And of course, World War I, this being 1914 to 1918, even though one can extend historically that particular era of fighting to 1919 because of the last gasps of the Austro-Hungarian Empire at the time, this was prior to all the sophisticated leaps and bounds and mountain climbing technical equipment, the ability to insulate oneself from the cold, the portability of everything that you needed in order to survive in these rather hostile regions. They didn't have that then, so it's even more horrific. So my friend and colleague Lester Grau works at the Foreign Military Studies Office. He and his colleague Bartels, Charles Bartels, wrote a book called Mountain Warfare and Other Lofty Problems. Foreign Mountain Combat Veterans Discuss Movement and Maneuver Training and Resupply. I put it in the show notes. If you're really interested in getting into the grisly and gory details of mountain warfare, this is a great place to go. Now, America, the Army in particular, for 10th Mountain Division, which isn't really training as a mountain division and hasn't done that since the end of World War II, nor have they fought in mountain fights per se, even when they found themselves in Afghanistan during those two decades. Rarely would elements beyond company level, which would be approximately 110 to 150 troops, actually don their light fighter gear and go head-to-head with the Taliban or whatever resistance organization they were fighting at the time in the Himalayas in Afghanistan and do that kind of thing. Now, there is more details and stories, and I've talked about this in the past when I covered the Russian experience in Afghanistan, where they did send beyond company level up, but you will rarely find battalions or above conducting concerted mountain operations where they are light fighting, which means they're in their leather personnel carriers. They've got their considerable kit on their back along with their weapons, and they climb these vertical faces or not so vertical faces to get to an area where they're going to go toe to toe with mountain fighters. Doesn't happen very much with First World Armies. First World Armies tend to use their investment in air power or artillery to shake them out of their mountain caves or areas with those instead of actually sending large groups of men into them. So in that book by Les Grau, he penned one very interesting overview in there with an Argentine Army lieutenant colonel by the name of Hernan Vasquez. So he quotes in here, quote, "A general who allows himself to be decisively defeated in an extended mountain position deserves to be court-martialed." That is Clausewitz. So let me offer some excerpts from this one essay in here. And in ground combat at high altitudes, a step back in time, quote, "High mountains are counter-technology. Mules are a good option for high-altitude logistics. They can use very narrow trails, can carry more than a human porter, and tire less over long distances. American mules can carry up to 20% of their body weight, 150 to 300 pounds, for 15 to 20 miles per day in mountains. Smaller mules in other locales will carry less. The maximum carry weight for an Argentine mule is between 200 and 250 pounds. However, this is for low and medium-altitude mountains. At high altitude, the maximum carrying weight drops below 200 pounds. Why are we discussing mules in the 21st century? Because this is one component of the capability to be defeated by the Afghans, the Taliban, and all the other resistance organizations throughout Afghanistan. Mules were a primary mover and shaker in their rather not sophisticated logistical chain. He goes on in an interesting excerpt from this essay, Combat at Altitude. There are two primary scenarios for combat at altitude. First, two states dispute the boundary between their countries and maintain forces supporting a rough line of demarcation along the disputed zone, Kashmir and Sichuan Glacier between India and Pakistan, and the Kamang Frontier Division between India and China. These are constant areas of conflict. In this scenario, opposing forces hold linear defenses along the line of demarcation, regardless of altitude, and conduct a fairly positional fight. Second, a light infantry force of guerrilla smugglers, bandits, or forces from a neighboring state transverses the mountainous region to establish base camps in the mountains from which they patrol, launch raids, or maintain smuggling routes. This has been the pattern for a number of high-altitude disputes, such as the Mau Mau Uprising, Soviet-Afghan War, Sendero Luminoso, Shining Path, in Peru, the Russo-Chechen Wars, and the Colombian efforts against the FARC and the ELN. In this scenario, the fighting does not automatically gravitate to a border zone, but usually stays below the tree line because it is so much easier, easier in air quotes when it comes to fighting, than fighting at high altitude. Again, same book I want to draw from an essay called Small Secrets of Great Mountains. And this is based on the work of Ikram Nazarov. And this was published in Infantry Magazine in the U.S., in 2010, but it was drawn from the May 2008 issue of the Russian Armeysky Sabornik, which is Army Digest that the Russians have. And for those listeners for whom this is not your first acquaintance with me in a podcast, but you've listened before, you know that I talk about the extraordinary Russian transformation that may not rival the scale and epic proportions of the 1943 to 1945 transformation of the Russian army. But what we've seen since the beginning of the 21st century is, I wouldn't say a complete dismissal of the artillery-centric USSR Red Army forces, but an update in which they are still artillery-centric, as a matter of fact. If one thinks of UAS, UAVs, and FPVs as simply yet another permutation in artillery fires, it starts to make sense of how effective the Russian army has been in the Ukraine in employing these new 21st century technologies. Ikram Nazarov apparently served in Afghanistan in combat in the 1980s with the Russian invasion of Afghanistan, and he has some small secrets of great mountains. He says some interesting things that are not necessarily counterintuitive, but one would have to think again and take a knee to fully grok what he's saying. He says, for instance, quote, "Another rule is that the shortest soldier always leads the column and everyone else keeps in step with him. In the mountains, the pace of movement depends on stride length. If a column is led by a soldier who is 6'6", his stride length will be a lot for even a person of average height to keep up with. A trailing short soldier will have to run, not walk. The soldier at the end of the line will soon begin to lag behind, which, by the way, is absolutely forbidden. Remember, the pace of movement must always be the same throughout the column. Mountain sickness, and there's only one way to deal with it, and soldiers must train regularly at altitude over several years. I say again, soldiers must train regularly at altitude over several years. Ask competitive skiers, ask snowboarders who happen to try to scale peaks that are rather high, maybe even 8,000 meter peaks on occasion, even though they wouldn't get up the entire face. One would have to spend weeks, months, if not years, to fully acclimate to be combat effective in these regions. The Indians and the Pakistanis, because of their engagements on the Kashmir ice fields, are probably the most advanced when it comes to the mountain medicine, trauma care, and acclimatization procedures and TTP that are necessary to make a light fighter at war in the mountain confines capable of doing that very thing. Now, I'm drawing from a variety of very savvy observations that Nazarov makes in here. And for instance, he says, get your soldiers accustomed to mountain wind, foul weather, sun, and frost. Only then will your soldiers look on foul weather as an everyday occurrence. And remember, foul weather points in both directions for friend and foe. He also says something interesting. Remember that the best position for firing in the mountains is a prone position. You should always press as hard as possible against the rock face so that you are almost invisible. If, however, you decide to shoot while sitting or standing, a good shooter is sure to spot you, and you can be sure he won't miss. The mountain units of foreign armies have spent years developing a well-worked-out technique for training Jagers. End of quote. A Jager is a German term for a mountain troop. Quote, what gear should you take to the mountains? The law here is to take only the absolute necessities. Anything extra is going to be a drag on both you, the march, and during the fight. So a lot of this seems intuitively obvious. I get it, but you will note two things. Number one, paying attention to detail is what will keep your soldiers alive, not only in the fight, but also left of bang, especially in these kind of hostile environments in which you have these finely tuned and exquisitely fit soldiers who are not only expending energy left of bang, preparing for combat, or right of bang in the midst of combat on a two-way range, but all the energy expenditure that goes into staying alive, if not being effective at altitude. These are difficult considerations. So if you get the opportunity to pick up this book, Mountain Warfare and Other Lofty Problems, Foreign Perspectives on High Altitude Combat, I've put a link to find the book in the show notes. I would urge you to give it a try. In the same article with Nazarov, Les leaves us with these considerations. Quote, Nazarov's tips seem like common sense, but they are common sense developed over 40 years of mountaineering experience. The ancient Roman legionnaires used to call themselves Marius's mules, muli meriani. The emperor Gaius Marius, 157 to 86 BC, initiated sweeping organizational reforms and greatly reduced the size of the logistics train by requiring each legionnaire to carry his armor, weapons, 15 days of rations, grain, and other gear. This onerous load weighed somewhere between 50 and 60 pounds. The normal day's march was about 20 miles. The Roman legion spent little time in the mountains. Today, the American infantryman goes into the mountains of Afghanistan carrying 85 pounds or more of lightweight gear. Afghans jokingly call the U.S. infantry the heavy mules. After all these centuries, the soldier's load is still important, particularly in the mountains. End of quote. When it comes to the soldier's load, by the way, that in and of itself is an interesting item to consider, because what we discover is that since Marius's mules, almost two centuries before the birth of Christ, up until this point, we have discovered that the soldier's load, and I'm speaking to the Western soldier's load because I'm not as familiar with Eastern conflict and what that soldier's load would be, has varied between 50 to 120 pounds. As a matter of fact, unless you're a mortarman or unless you happen to be an infantryman, whether light or mechanized in the U.S. Army, your emergency approach loads, as authorized in the FMs, is up to 140 pounds. I have been under slightly less than that. I think it was 110 pounds total. And after a period of time, you're simply looking at your feet and you're losing all situational awareness as a result of this burden. And I would say, on a side note, as a result of this burden, I spent nearly a quarter century in uniform in both active duty and the reserves. And what I discovered is that it takes a toll on your body that you pay for until your end of days. As my listeners know, I love footnotes. I tend to track down footnotes. And I found an interesting footnote to the essay that I was just reading out of. And it was by Alexei Svetlanov, called Oso Benosti Ravs Vetki I Gorka. And it was Peculiarities of Mountain Reconnaissance. I found it fascinating to take a look at that. And others managed to get it translated. So for me, when it comes to contemporaneous mountain conflict, I think the Russians, for the most part, sort of broke the mold, if not really took seriously, the hand receipts and the footnotes to how to make that work and have integrated it into this new Russian armed forces that I'm talking about. And of course, they have some mountain folk among them who they have been both at war and allied with in Chechnya, who may be some of the most able mountain fighters of our age. And there's lots to learn from them when it comes to this kind of thing. Did I talk about climbing? Did I talk about the difficulties of that? Did I talk about what it takes when one is in full combat kit to do those various things? What are the belay methods that one would use to negotiate mountain obstacles? If you come across a river, how do you negotiate that particular water obstacle, whether under fire or not under fire? And organizing and conducting the physical training for soldiers in the mountains, this is left of bang, and this is so critical. If it doesn't occur, soldiers will die, and you will suffer defeat in the U.S. case once again. So my friend and correspondent Eomar at Diligent News on April 13th, 2024, he had a interesting piece called A Wider War Iran, where he tackled some of these things that I've been discussing today. His conclusion is rather interesting. Quote, as I am writing this, news broke that Iran had launched a drone attack against Israel in retaliation for its bombing the Iranian embassy. The Wall Street Journal is reporting that the United States intercepted and shot down several of these drones. This, in turn, could make U.S. launch sites valid targets, at least in the minds of Iranian leaders. If this were to occur, the war would likely continue to escalate. End of quote. Remember, this is a year ago. Quote, I want to reiterate, I do not see a winnable objective for us in this fight. We, Americans, could surely hit some targets in Iran, but I do not believe we can do so with impunity, nor can the Israelis. Fighting Iran will not be similar to fights with insurgent groups we have fought in the past. It will be worse. We will not be able to line up thousands of troops and tanks on the border and push through the country like we did in Iraq. The mountains are likely largely impassable, and it's unclear if any of the surrounding nations would volunteer to host this force. The war hawks, whether bought by the military-industrial complex or its sister group of Israeli lobbyists, will clamor for war. They aren't motivated by America's best interests. They are motivated by money, as I described in War is Still a Racket. The only thing worth fighting for is lives and our rights, and neither are at risk here. The American leaders must avoid any further involvement and seek immediate de-escalation. If we continue on this path, the best case, we further lose our influence and power in the region. The worst case scenario is a wider war that spreads even beyond the Middle East. The conditions are ripe for world war, and we must tread carefully to maintain peace. End of quote. From your lips to Odin's ears, Eomar, thank you for that. By the way, I have a conjecture concerning that April 2024 Iranian flight of missiles into Israel last year. My suspicion is that the Iranian armed forces and whoever their Department of the Army or Department of the Air Force civilians may be went to all their ASPs, their ammunition supply points, and the huge caverns that host their missile storage and missile maintenance and prepping and such. They went through there with a clipboard and said, I need you to take the oldest lot numbers that we have in total and get them ready to go, spin them up, spool them up, and get them ready for launch. The reason for that is that in that April retaliation, and I put that in air quotes, against Israel at the time last year, nearly a year ago, My suspicion is they did not want to necessarily hit any Israeli targets to score tactical, operational, or even strategic wins, but to use it as a reconnaissance by fire so that through savvy operators and sleeper cells on the ground, colleagues in that area, maybe on the other side of the Gazan line, or anybody who could pay attention with a notebook and binoculars, to start establishing time hacks for responses. Where did the responses come from? How did they address the leakers? Were they able to address the leakers in their integrated air and missile defense system? My suspicion is what the Iranians were doing was quite literally sending these in there to make them open up, spin up, have all the ELINT traffic, electronic intelligence traffic, all the signals intelligence traffic, and find out just how it would react to mass fires inbound to Israeli airspace so they could take notes and better prepare left of bang. We shall see whether that occurred or not. That is my suspicion. So I'd like to leave you with several observations. The first one would be, when it comes to the matchup of these new revolutions in military affairs, whether it be it's autonomous targeting, robotics, mud to space, hypersonic munitions and such, how is that going to affect the conduct of mountain warfare? Mountain warfare being among the most horrific and personal of warfare, and that's really saying something because all war is hell. But in this case, how are these new permutations that we are seeing in the 21st century going to affect the light fighter in mountain fighting? I have a rather dim view of this because I think that, as I have mentioned before in previous podcasts, especially in the podcast episode where I talked about the infantry finally after 3,000 years having maybe to fold its colors, if not find a brand new way to conduct its affairs on the battlefield, because all flesh is forfeit. Now, this would be on the Ukrainian plains. Remember, I had mentioned that only 5% of the Ukraine is mountainous, and the remainder is what the Germans would refer to as tank country. But in this case, what we've discovered is that without the wrinkles and the folds and relatively flat fields, quite literally in the salvo competition, that is FPVs and UAVs flying about looking for things to kill or render mission incapable or catastrophically kill them. This would include vehicles. This would include tanks. This would include missile facilities. This would include artillery batteries. But what we've discovered in the last year of the fight, and one can maybe say that the entirety of the fight, both sides, the Ukraine and Russia, have taken these artillery permutations, and I will insist that that is a great way to think about this, of FPVs, and use them to quite literally search out, find, and destroy individual soldiers, soldiers who are in a fire team, soldiers who may be gathered about in a squad or a platoon or even company-size elements, and using these to prosecute them. Nothing stops, for the most part, without a few technological nuances and dials changed, for this to happen in mountain warfare. And the worst part about mountain warfare when it comes to the use of UAVs and FPVs is that soldiers, by their very nature in this particular kind of warfare, mountain warfare, aren't going to be able to do a lot of running on a horizontal plane if all they're presented with is vertical and a little less than vertical planes, which of course, when it comes to human physiology, exhausts and slows down the soldier, which makes them even more vulnerable. So when I started this, I sort of alluded to the fact that Alexander, back in the day, the Macedonian Alexander, before the birth of Christ, had quite a hard time fighting in the mountains. As a matter of fact, it would be the mountains, Afghanistan included, that would be the conquest he did not quite achieve because of the mountain fastness. Also, as we fast forward through times from the classical ancient warfare to the Middle Ages to medieval times and such, we find that mountains, again, regardless of technology, provide sometimes almost intractable military problems for which there aren't solutions. Oh, by the way, maybe that means there are not problems in the first place. Here's my other observation. There is a gentleman by the name of James C. Scott, one of my favorite anthropologists, and I don't have many of those because of the intellectual and philosophical corruption of that particular academic enterprise, but he remains a standout for me, and I own probably four of his books. He died several years ago, unfortunately. A very savvy observer when it came to anarchical infrastructures and societal and cultural markers of how folks achieved that level of anarchy. And in the academic bowels and septic tanks of the Western University, he managed to come out with some real gems. And he turned me on to something I hadn't known about before, which is an area called Zomia in Southeast Asia. This is the Southeast Asian Massif. And it was proposed by an anthropologist by the name of Jean Michaud in 1997 to discuss the human societies inhabiting the lands above an elevation of approximately 300 meters in the southeastern portion of the Asian landmass, thus not merely in the uplands of conventional mainland Southeast Asia. It spanned across 10 countries, Southwest China, Northeast India, Eastern Bangladesh, parts of Myanmar, Thailand, Vietnam, Laos, Cambodia, the peninsula of Malaysia, and Taiwan, but we're going to take Taiwan out of that. The indigenous population encompassed within these limits numbers approximately 100 million. And the notion of the Southeast Asian Massif overlaps geographically with the eastern segment of Van Schendel's notion of Zomia, which he proposed in 2002. And this was in turn championed by James C. Scott, because it overlapped the geography there, and he called it Zomia in 2009. So what we're looking at here is this massive area, and one of my favorite phrases of all time in academia was coined by James C. Scott, in which he called it a state-repellent region, because no matter how many times those countries that I just listed tried to establish suzerainty and domination over these areas, they had the hardest time. And this sort of harkens to what happened in the Appalachians in America until the 1920s, where it was quite literally the Eastern Wild Wild West. You would find it, of course, with the frontier diaspora from the Atlantic seaboard from the 17th century onward in the United States, of course, achieving light speed in the 18th and 19th century with the settlement of the frontiers, as frontiersmen were fleeing the Constitution pell-mell as they could. We find the same thing occurring with the Carpathian Mountains in Romania, what's known as Transylvania. We find it with the Chechens, for instance, in their mountainous areas. Wherever you find these mountainous areas, and as a matter of fact, Zomia just so happens to have transnational highlands near the Himalayas too, of course, if you take a look at a map. So it is sort of proximate to what's called Southwest Asia, which would include Afghanistan, and you find that these state-repellent regions not only are state-repellent, but tend to be military-repellent, where they are very hard to govern. They are ungovernable or minimally governed spaces. As a result of that, they tend to follow their own kind of logic instead of a centralized or religiously harmonized core with a long, distinctive political existence. They find themselves to be much more individualistic instead of collectivist. And again, this does not take away from cultural values that would be shared between clan, blood, and culture, especially when it comes to these places in Asia, which are also informed by blood feuds in the way they organize their societies. And I wanted to leave this thought with a quote from James C. Scott, in which he describes that these tribes in Zomia, as it were, are conscious refugees from state rule and state-centered economies. from a preface to one of his books. I think it was The Art of Not Being Governed, an Anarchist History of Upland Southeast Asia. Quote, "Hill tribes seen from the Valley Kingdoms as our living ancestors, what we were like before we discovered wet rice cultivation, Buddhism, and civilization, or on the contrary, best understood as runaway fugitive maroon communities who have, over the course of two millennia, been fleeing the oppressors of state-making projects in the valleys, slavery, conscription, taxes, corvée labor, epidemics, and warfare," end of quote. So I would urge you, if you get the opportunity, to read The Art of Not Being Governed, and if you get the opportunity, in Upping the Ante, a Journal of Theory and Action, which I don't recommend for once, but in the interview, Points of Resistance and Departure, an interview with James C. Scott, dated November 20th, 2010. I will put it in the show notes. I would urge you to take a look at that. It is fascinating. So here we have a cross-germination where not only am I drawing from military conflict from Alexandrian times and those Macedonian futile attempts to best mountain peoples, we fast forward all the way to this time. And here we have, for instance, James C. Scott, not a warfare or conflict specialist of any stripe, offering us, I think, some very interesting knowledge tidbits in a cross-disciplinary fashion on why mountain peoples tend to be a tough nut to crack militarily. So I've given you this brief discussion on the history of mountain warfare, and I haven't touched hardly anything because of the brevity and necessary economy that I have to practice in trying to keep these podcast episodes scaled to approximately 1 hour. Maybe in the future I'll get brave enough to go beyond that hour timeline when I have sufficient time to prepare to give you something interesting to listen to. But here we are. We've looked at some of the historical analogs. We've looked at some of the contemporaneous things that are going on as far as the saber rattling against Yemen and Iraq, and in conflict futurism, which of course is a big part of my job here, is to forecast, if not predict, but forecast how things are changing, how these huge sea changes in the way armies fight and folks conduct warfare, and the way I stand by my prognostication that the U.S. in the West is not prepared for any of these revolutions and military affairs that are going on. And today I took you on a small side trip to visit mountain warfare so that we could examine that and some of the implications for war ahead. So thanks for listening. This is Bill. And if you wish to get in touch with me, you can get in touch with me at email. My email is cgpodcast@pm.me. That is cgpodcast@pm.me. Love to hear from you. I have a Substack. You will find the Substack address in the show notes. And if you get the opportunity to pass on to friends, family, colleagues, interested parties who may enjoy listening to my bloviations here at Chasing Ghost or on War Notes, please make sure that happens. And if you are kind enough to leave a review or stars at the podcast vendor of your choice where you are within earshot of my voice, I would be honored and obliged if you would do so. This is Bill, out.